How would you like to scale your company to $100 million? In today's episode, Joshua Gold will tell us how he scaled his company from $6 million to $100 million and how he is implementing a lot of really interesting techniques to do so. And what's so special about Joshua is he's the CEO, investor, and operator known for scaling businesses through disciplined execution across private equity style value creation, M&A, and modern go-to-market strategies. And he is the CEO of The Big Word, a global language technology and services company serving enterprise and government clients, where he helped grow the business from roughly $6 million to over $100 million in revenue. And he did so by building the operating system, commercial engine, and leadership cadence required to scale. So, Joshua, tell us about how did you end up scaling a company from $6 million to $100 million?
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu. Mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
Well, that's a loaded question, Lily. I actually started out in telemarketing. So in about 2004, I came into the Big Word and I was on the night shift. And my job was to call US companies from our headquarters in Leeds in the UK and find clients. So I guess that's where it started. And I had great mentors. It was a much smaller business back then. And you said, it was around $6 million in revenue. And from there, it was a mixture of luck and fortune and ultimately making your own luck and putting yourself in a position to succeed. I never went to college. People always ask me, I'm based out of the US. They always ask me, oh, where do you go to college? And, you know, they're always shocked that I never went to college. So I've made up this this fake college name from time to time. But the reality is I went to the College of Life. And in the College of Life, you learn skills that I think can carry you through those first few years of your career. Because you can't rely on theory and you can't rely on textbooks and you can't rely on the prestigiousness of a university or a good college, as we would say in the US. What you do rely on, though, is relationships and building them and trust and empathy, all the same things that people who do go to college have to rely on, but you're learning them from the age of 17, 18 years old. And you also learn the importance of finding great mentors, finding people that can lift you up. And there's a thought where you're only going to be as successful as the circle of friends that you're in. And the good thing for me was I managed to find great people to surround myself with that weren't victims. They didn't have a victim mentality. They didn't care where you came from. They didn't care how your boy was up. They cared who you were and what you could bring to the party. So I think, you know, that's the start of the story, is really coming into business, not knowing much, but having some really good people, some really good mentors around. And then from there, you build relationships and you build credibility. And you've not got experience and you're not a wise head on old shoulders. So what can you bring? You can bring effort. You can bring this enthusiasm and energy that can only come with someone who hasn't really felt the fear of failure before, because you know you're so young, you're not really thinking about failure as you do as you get old. You've got nothing to lose, so you throw yourself in, and that's what you bring. And from there, I went from running the telemarketing team to starting to write government bids and starting to build relationships with departments of the British government. My first relationship was with one of the big departments in the UK government. I won't say who they are because we're in the middle of a big and large bid for them right now. But I got to know them, and I got to know their pain points, and I got to know what they were dissatisfied with. And they were working with an American company, and they were paying £5 for 1 minute of over the phone interpreting. So that's where an interpreter joins a three-way call. And I figured that, I could probably pay people around 50 pence a minute, which is still £30 an hour. And we're talking about 2004. To be paid £30 an hour is still pretty good. And I could pay them 50 pence a minute. So why don't I charge them £1 a minute, and then figure out how to operate the contract with the other 50 pence that I get to keep as a gross margin? So I had no idea what we were doing. I had no idea about the technology that was involved in this, but I did know the client, and they did trust me, and I understood their pain points. So they were paying £5 a minute, and it was really, really expensive. They were happy with the service. The company was a good company. They had good relationships, but they didn't have the budget. So we put out this RFP, and we were a $6 million business, so roughly about £4 million. And this deal was worth around $6 million a year. So it's doubling the business size. And I remember getting a call. I was on Charlotte Street in London. I got a call from the head of procurement at the time. It was a guy called Keith Stewart. It's funny how the names stick with you. And he said, I'm really delighted to tell you that we're going to award you this contract. And I screamed like I'd won the lottery. And people were looking at me, and it's almost like an out-of-body experience as you're screaming and yelping down Charlotte Street, a 21-year-old that time. And he said to me, listen, I've got to have less phone calls now with the other bidders and the incumbents. You're not going to let me down, right? And of course, without any fear, I said, of course not. And the months after that, I think I probably did let them down because I had no idea what I was doing. But I flew to America. I found people who knew what they were doing. I told them I had this $6 million contract. If you could help me, I can help you. And I bought the technology that didn't exist. We had to invent basically the virtual call center. And we survived that first 12 months. And it was really, really good. And that doubled the size of the business. And from that moment on, we understood the power of these larger government contracts. And we understood that we were solving real problems. People needed to communicate. And the final barrier of communication is language. And this was critical in the court systems so that victims can seek justice. It was critical in the prisons so that the prisons can communicate with their population, of which roughly 20% are limited in English. It's critical in the hospitals. And these people that have limited English were bringing huge commerce to the UK and to the US. They're worth a lot of money if you can get them working and if you can get them contributing to society, which the vast majority do. It's a huge net gain for the country. So that's what the big word then stood for, was we are going to resolve that problem, that we have to get these people operational and working for us and contributing to society and paying taxes, or we have to get them out if they're not going to do that. So we bid for the immigration, we bid for the border forces, we bid for the police stations, we bid for the hospitals. And we did so knowing that this is a solution which is really, really hard to deliver because it's got to be like Uber. Because if you have to be able to press a button and someone has to turn up, and they have to turn up quickly in person, or there has to be a video version of that, or there has to be, you can drop the visual and only have audio. And then AI's come along and disrupted the whole, since 2013 was a major disruption. So we then became very product focused, which was unusual in my industry because everyone was seeing themselves as an agency. And we built out a big RFP team, we built out a big account management team. And then when we could have taken our foot off the gas and just made a lot of money, we actually didn't take a penny out of the business. And to this day, I've been involved in the big word since I was 2020, since 2004, there's been one dividend where the shareholders have taken money out of the business, and 75% was sold of the business in 2021 to a private equity group. So those are the only two times when any money has really changed hands. The rest of the time, then every single year, we plow 100% of our profits back into our solutions.
Thank you. So tell me first, how did you manage to go from telemarketer to like selling so, like making such massive bids?
So, in telemarketing ultimately is a sales job. And, a lot of people look at a telemarketer as some kind of lowly, uneducated script reader. I didn't see it that way. I saw it as a way in and an opportunity. And I started building relationships. And I actually had a really good manager back in those days. And then I became the manager when she left. And then after that, I realized that there was a ceiling to how much you could make. So I asked to go and start going out into the field, being a salesperson, because then I could earn some significant commission. So I looked at who was the spenders. And, in the time, our clients were like Honda and Hitachi. We had a lot of Japanese clients because we had bought a Japanese company called Mitaka in the Midlands of the UK. And but the government was spending 1 million pounds, 2 million pounds, 3 million, five, even more. So why spend all that time trying to find out who the head of procurement is in a large private international company when in the government sector they say, I'm buying, this is how much I'm buying for, this is what I'm buying. And then the other thing is, I've always been mission driven. Like, I don't want to wake up in the morning and think about how much money I'm making. Back in the day, I needed commission. I was basically a minimum wage employee, but I didn't want to do that forever because once you can cover your basic bills, I wanted to have a purpose. And I saw what we were doing. I saw we were helping society. We were important. We were on the front lines in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, and in the prisons and in the hospitals. And we were really helping people. We're only a small cog in the wheel. We're not the policeman that's putting their life on the line all the time. But every single day, there is a big word interpreter that helps bring life into the world. Every single day, there's a big word interpreter that's going to save a life. And I just play a tiny part in that, but I do play a part. And you get to decide what you do with your time and your life. And this was exciting. So I decided I wanted to go more on the government side, or in the UK, we call it public sector side.
Thank you. And when you made the bid, because normally you cannot sell something unless you know that the cost is going to be low enough for you to actually make a profit. Did you have a guarantee at the time that you could do that, or were you kind of like pushing your luck in a sense to that you could actually offer the translators, the interpreters, the kind of wage or you could pay them basically a lot less. Because,
Sure.
yeah, were you certain that you could do that?
Yeah. So, first of all, I was lucky. The big word's always been an incredibly entrepreneurial business, and they're willing to take a risk. At the end of the day, you have to pay interpreters and translators, together we call them linguists. Interpretation being the written word and translation being the spoken word. But you have to pay these people a wage that makes it worth them showing up, or simply they're gonna not show up. And But at the same time, who's paying these people the wage? It's the taxpayers. And therefore, you have to have a meeting in the middle. And the big word's always been good at understanding where that middle ground is. But when we write the RFPs, even to this day, it's not a science, it's an art. And there has been many times where we are paying interpreters and translators far more money than we're making. And you just got to do that. We used to have a huge contract in the Joint Multinational Readiness Center, which is a NATO military base that's run by the US in Germany. And we were losing upwards of $500,000 a year just to pay the contractors on that. I've had another one, a police contract in the UK, where I've been losing $500,000 a year in the past. Now, of course, you don't last very long in business if you get it wrong on a consistent basis. So I like to think at this point we've got a really sophisticated management team, phenomenal people in our finance department, led by a incredibly intelligent CFO who understands the commercials of business. We've got a hugely sophisticated data team and operating officer. So you build layers as you get big. But when you're smaller, and I know a lot of your audience are on the kind of small to medium sized businesses, this is much riskier, and you've got to be willing to take the risk. But you also have to be willing to cover off that risk. So, in other words, you have to deliver in any contract you get into, whether it's for government or private sector, whether you're making money or you're not. And as long as you deliver, what we found is you can live to fight another day. You can then go and rebid. You can change your pricing. You can evolve. You can get better. And some you're going to win more on than you expect, and some you're going to lose more on.
Thank you. How did you manage to deliver on the promise of getting an interpreter to actually show up at the time that someone would actually need that kind of interpreter online, for example, in a system similar to Uber? How did you manage to deliver on that?
Well, I think it's a bit like the Tesla method. You say you're going to do something, you sell it, and then almost you got no choice. You got to find a way. So Elon Musk said, "We're going to make a self-driving car." Well, there was no infrastructure within the roads. I don't know if you remember, but self-driving cars, people said you would have to rebuild the entire road network and road system, and you would have to have signals everywhere on the road and in the car, and you'd have to have hundreds of cameras around the car, and this infrastructure wasn't realistic, and we were probably much more likely to be having flying cars. But today I came to work, and I didn't drive. I don't have a chauffeur. I literally got in my Tesla, I pressed the button, it drove out the car park in my apartment block, and it parked in my space underneath the office. And it required zero inputs from me. And it's very much the same way as how we look at the big word. We come up with these solutions based on what governments need and what government departments require. I'll give you an example. For the police, you can only hold someone in a cell for so long. And if you can't interview them because you can't speak in their language, you could have a potential terrorist, a murderer, a rapist walking the streets hours later, if you can't provide an interpreter. So, you start from there. You've got to provide someone, and you could get that call at 12 a.m. You could get it at 2 a.m. You could get it at 4 p.m. It could come any time, and it can come in any language. And from that point on, we've decided that we have to build a workflow-based system, a piece of technology, which is WordSync. And that's pretty much what we sell. So just in the same way as Airbnb doesn't own any of its hotels or apartments, we don't own our linguists. They're freelancers. But Airbnb owns all of the workflows within the Airbnb website, and and that's the same within WordSync. So we needed a way that our clients can go onto an application and decide, do I want an over-the-phone interpreter, which we pretty much guarantee 98% of the time, in under 60 seconds, you're going to have a live human interpreter that's qualified to do that job, are we going to have a video? You know, like we could have a video now. We could get one of our interpreters, in theory, in the call, and we could be doing this in Russian and in English. Or do we, or do we need someone in person? And a lot of the time, for mission critical work, it needs to be in person. So we have to build a piece of technology that allowed people to request this on the front end. On the back end, we needed something that was good for our own staff to administer it. And then we also needed a separate application. So this is the third WordSync application for our linguists. So that they can scroll down and see, okay, these are the jobs in my area. I just click on them. And we built something called the Linguist Network. And the idea behind that was within three clicks, you can review your jobs, you can accept a job, and you can invoice for the job. Which is, we like to joke, it's a business in a box. You can work for any of our competitors. There's no performance management. You're really running your own business. And we wanted to make ourselves the easiest language service provider to work with. And that way, if we had more work than anyone else in our target markets of the US and UK, mainly public sector and healthcare, then linguists would flock to us because that's where they were getting the work. And we could keep them busy. And so that was the strategy. And then we had to go out and do market capture. We had to go out and sell this. So again, we went back to, getting to know the clients, getting to know their pain points well ahead of RFPs coming out. And then when the RFP comes out, there's very strict rules in government. So we follow those rules. We price it where we think we need to be in order to win it. And if we can't price it where we think we need to be in order to win it, we actually don't bid for it. And about 80% of all the RFPs that we review, we make a no bid decision because we think that we cannot price it where we need to be in order to win it, even if we might have the best solution.
Thank you. So, in terms of winning government contracts, I'm sure there is a lot of competition. How can someone win a government contract or a really large contract where there is a large competition?
Yeah, I mean, we were just awarded a contract in the last few weeks that's $50 million a year. It's a big contract. It's our largest contract and our largest ever win. And in that, there was over 60 competitors. So this is where it's a re it, you can't just dabble in it. I don't know if you watch Formula One, but so this analogy may be lost on you, but I'll try and make it relevant. The difference between a Formula One car that's going to win the race and one that's going to come last is negligible. For the average person, you're going to look at these cars and you're going to say they look identical to me, and they have the same size engine in. So what is the difference? It's tiny little aerodynamic changes on the car that over a 75-mile race can make the difference between coming first or last. And that's how we look at our business. We're building technology. And if you remember, I said we invest 100% of our profits. We run almost like a non-for-profit. We're not, but we run like that, where we invest our money in the product. And what we've come to understand is if we can automate a huge amount of that value add stuff through our WordSync platform, then we can reduce our price but still add the value. So we deployed AI self-driving workflows in 2013 for the first time ever. We deployed in 2006 web service APIs that integrated into the back ends of our clients' infrastructure to reduce their administration costs. So, through these self-driving workflows, through these integrations, you can start to create that at least puts you in the top 5% of contenders. And then you've got to beat three or four other mega contenders, if you like. And to do that, you've got to really understand the nuances of each contract, where the pain points are, and that's where you rely on your sales teams.
Thank you. Tell us when you scaled, What were some of the biggest lessons that you learned?
You can't scale too slow. I think there's a lot of people that will disagree with me, and they'll come in and they'll say, if you scale too fast, you'll run out of cash and you'll be out of business. And there's a lot of truth to that. But the problem is, why, well, let me re-ask you the question to you and your audience. Why scale? What's the point? I mean, you're scaling because you're trying to grow. And if you're making 10% of 10 million pounds or dollars, that's $1 million. You make 10% of $1 billion, and now you're making 100 million in margin. So, a lot of the reason why people scale is to be able to just grow and make more money. But there's another reason why people scale, and that's because costs can come down, right? Your unit rate typically can be acquired cheaper if you're buying more units. But we actually don't see that in the language industry because we are essentially selling people's time. We're buying and selling people's time. So if you're an interpreter or a translator, you've only got, let's say you get prepared to work 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, you've only got 50 hours. And there's a lot of work out there. There's more work, even with AI, there's far more work than there are people. So you have a choice who you're going to give that time to. So we had to utilize our WordSync platform to be able to scale our operations and make the benefits there because we can't make the benefits with the actual linguists themselves. So the huge benefit of that is we have to recruit all these people for every single contract, and that's incredibly challenging. But the cost to operate these contracts isn't really hugely different to us, whether it's a $10 million contract or a $100,000 contract, providing it goes through the WordSync platform. And that's where scale becomes exciting, but it's also where it delivers value for our clients. And our clients are primarily hospitals, prisons, police stations, areas of quite, quite distressing places. I would say if you are in a room with one of my interpreters, it's probably not a good day.
Thank you. So, tell us about what would you say what would you say AI impacted your business? Like, in what sense did AI impact your business? Because I would think now that AI can do automatic translations into like 20 languages at the same time, don't like governments implement that by themselves, and technically a lot of them don't need you? Or would you say that they haven't done it yet? And you were able to integrate this kind of technology, AI technology, into your business, and you are able to leverage it and charge for it rather than letting the governments do it by themselves.
Yeah, so first of all, in my industry, machine learning, which is what you want to be, when you say AI, you're probably talking about large language model AI, which is machine learning, by the way. It's just large language model machine learning, but that has existed in my industry since 2013 in the mainstream. So it's being used by a lot of companies. So that's when the disruption happened. As of today, it's estimated that 99% of all language services are actually generated by artificial intelligence. So the industry continues to grow at around 6% a year is revenue, but that's because that 1% is growing. And the amount of corpora or content that the world creates is doubling every 18 months. So that 1% every 18 months doubles, and the way and how it flushes out is it grows the actual revenue of the industry by approximately 6%, but it's not growing evenly because there is the mom and pop shops or the interpreters. And I understand you used to be an interpreter, Lily, so you'll know this. There are interpreters who work with other interpreters, and they're really busy. They've got so much work, and they're not worried about AI. They're going to be absolutely fine in the future. Then you've got the big words, and we've invested heavily in AI orchestration, building AI into the workflow. We provide AI tools. Already through the WordSync platform, and you can have human in the loop AI, and you can basically choose which service you want to do. And we quality assess it, we quality assure it, we make sure that it's HIPAA compliant if it's in the US healthcare system, or it's GDPR UK or GDPR EU compliant, if you know, depending on where it is. We have a lot of wraparound services. But what concerns me is I think there's this huge middle market in the language service industry, and I think they're in trouble because they have overheads. You know, they have senior leadership and management, but they don't necessarily have enough revenue to spread the huge tech investment that the likes of the big word are making in AI and AI orchestration. And every single year, we're spending millions of pounds in building AI tools. Imagine being a 10 million pound company right now in the industry, and you've got to spend millions of pounds. You're probably not even making millions of pounds to be able to do that. Now, I think that this is where you're going to get consolidation. So you're going to get those companies either band together or jump on board and merge with companies like the big word. And I think through that, you're going to get really exciting solutions come up because the scale will be there. So it's pretty exciting to be in the industry right now because we've already gone through the massive AI risk that everyone else is now having to handle. And, you know, we're 10 years into this, or more than 10 years into this.
Thank you. If you were dropped into another $6 million company tomorrow, what would your first 90-day scaling plan look like?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm almost institutionalized at the big word, Lily, but I do invest in other businesses and startups, and this is something that we sit around and debate on a fairly regular basis. I invested in a startup called Falafel Love. They make frozen falafel balls and in supermarkets, and I have another investment in the healthcare space for Audley Capital. And it's what everyone talks about is how do we reach scale? How do we get to a point where we become unbeatable? And so the first thing I'll do is say, forget about that. What do the clients really need? What makes you, and I'm going to steal this from my father, but what makes you irresistible? And as my dad likes to tell me, that means too tempting to resist. And it's really a product first approach that I would take in the first 90 days. So I'll be looking at, you know, do people really need us? Do we really solve a problem? Or are we a solution that's looking for a problem, which I think a lot of businesses are. So first of all, make sure you've got a real problem. The big word serves a problem, you know, of communication. It's an obvious one. It's in the media all the time. And from there, I look at, okay, how do we solve the problem? What is the product? And I work backwards. And then I'm looking for investor clients. These are people who are early adopters who have to acknowledge that you might not be the ideal supplier. You might not, you know, to use an American term, check every box. You might not be big enough. But I'm going to them and I'm offering them a deal. I'm going to sell you at a 20% unit rate discount. I may even offer stock in the business, you know, if it's a big enough deal, if they can help me get the scale. And in return, I'm going to solve this problem that all of these companies in my industry have been faffing around with and messing around with and unable to solve for a long period of time. And, you know, that's ultimately what Falafel Love did, which is a plant-based falafel ball. And the problem it solved there was vegans and people who wanted to eat healthier didn't have any fast food that was healthy because it's a lot of, you know, I'm a vegan. A lot of vegan stuff is junk and actually not healthy for you at all. So it solved this problem and it brought the price down, but the quality of the food was extremely high. And, you know, and supermarkets across the US said, you know, I'm going to displace products in my frozen food aisles, which is really, really difficult to get into with your falafel balls. And I think in nearly every supermarket, they're the best-selling plant-based frozen food items. So, you know, it doesn't you don't have to solve some crazy problem for a government, you know, to be successful. You just have to solve the problem for your target audience. Hopefully, that answers your question, Lily.
Yes. Tell us, what did you have to unlearn to become an effective $100 million plus CEO?
Well, to be a CEO, I think, and I hope you don't mind, but on podcasts, I like to be no filter, very honest. I'm not wearing a tie and a shirt and, showing you some crazy busy office in the background. So this is my unfiltered version, Lily, and I hope your audience doesn't mind it. But in order to get to the top and to be a CEO, you actually have to be almost, you have to have blind faith in yourself, which will sometimes be referred to as arrogance. And you have to really strongly believe in your way because you know yourself, Lily. You've got this podcast. You're going to have all the haters. You're going to have the people who say it can't work and why it can't work and why they've done it for all these years and you're doing it wrong. And you have to believe that you know better than them. And you probably don't, but you have to believe it to even try it because no one would try it if you otherwise. And what you have to then unlearn at some point is you have to realize you might have great intuition, you might have great knowledge and great skills, but at some point you do have to unlearn the arrogance. You have to become a great student again. And that's what I am. I like to pass my knowledge over in these podcasts. But believe me, for everyone I do, 70 hours I'm doing studying and learning. I'm listening to other people's podcasts. I listen to your podcasts. That's how I found you.
Wow, interesting. Tell us, what would be your one-page scale readiness checklist for CEOs that are currently at $5 to $10 million? What would they need to put in place?
Yeah, so I'll try and give you some practical. I mean, the number one thing is, do you really have an irresistible product? Have you really been honest with yourself? And I advise different companies, even very big brands, and quite often they're not honest with themselves. They've drunk their own Kool-Aid. So if I was going to put together a checklist, my first thing would be is every month, let's really review our product, and is it living up to what we're promising people? And let's do a gap analysis because nobody's product knocks it out the park every single month. Products aren't set things. They're living, they're breathing, they're changing. The pricing is often dynamic. Their supply chain is moving. So that's number one. But the other thing is you have to bring your supply chain along the ride with you. So the big word has 15,000 interpreters and translators that work with us every single year. 5,000 of them work with us nearly every single month. So that's the other part of the checklist. Have you really understood your supply chain? Not just the 150 of them that are really noisy and write online and contact the special interest groups, but all 15,000 of them. Are you speaking to them? And practical things that you can do, and what the big word is we run town halls. We invite our interpreters and translators to meet us. We even invite our clients sometimes so that they can speak directly to clients. And we listen to them. And nearly all of the innovation around our interpreter app and how quickly we pay, which now if in some contracts is every 2 weeks, it used to be between 30 and 30 plus days. All of those were through listening to our supply chain. Because without your supply chain, you can't do it. You've got to have the backing and the support of your supply chain. So those are the two kind of number one and number two on the checklist. The third one is, do you have the team? You can't scale on your own. The alpha dog doesn't walk at the front of the pack. It walks towards the back and it surveils. That's the job of the CEO. The job of the CEO, sometimes you have to be in the front. You have to go out in front of a client. You have to speak to them. Sometimes you have to, as they say, shake hands and kiss babies. But for the most part, your job is to surveil, is to understand what's going on, to see the threats before they become a threat, and alert the rest of your pack. So do you have a pack? Do you have the right people in place? Without the right people in place, you can bootstrap things to a point, but you're never going to get full scale bootstrapping. At some point, you're going to have to spend a lot more than you're making. So, I would say that's another key part of the checklist. Hopefully, that's some good actionable advice, Lily, for your listeners.
Thank you. I find that becoming almost like a relationship master can sometimes fast track you onto a huge contract you wouldn't normally get. Tell us about some key actions that you took in order to kind of like fast track yourself, aside from like doing your due diligence and applying for stuff and, you know, doing all the key things that you mentioned already. Is there anything that needs to happen on a relationship master kind of level so that you do get considered for certain things? Because I find that it takes a lot of confidence once you actually have a person who can assign you a big contract, but at the same time, you cannot look too needy, too desperate. And there's so many different things that I think the super high caliber people look at that can scare them off. And tell us about what are the kind of things that you could say scare people off, and what are the kinds of things that should be there that give confidence to a person that can give you that kind of contract so that you actually close the deal and not just have like a great conversation that leads to nothing.
Sure. So in my world, which is predominantly healthcare and government bidding, these are regulated procurement processes. So I don't want to say the relationship counts for not much, but at the end of the day, these are processes, and but that doesn't mean say that you can't have a relationship with all the users and really understand where their pain points are. And it doesn't take a lot, by the way. You can, in my business, I do this. I can walk into any court in the UK and just ask people, do you work with an interpreter? Most of them are going to work, say yes. And I can go into a hospital and ask the nurses, do you work with interns? Just tell me. And I can do this in clients, in sorry, in potential clients, not just existing clients. And go into a hospital system I went into one recently in Miami U, and I spoke to the nurse and I said, tell me about your experience working with interpreters. And she said, oh, it's terrible. We have really serious situations and conversations to have, and the doctor's waiting for an interpreter to show up, and eventually the doctor has to go home because the doctor's got a family and their shift finished 2 hours ago and the interpreter still hasn't shown up. And then the patient has to wait a full day and no decisions are, can be made. And so you start to learn, you start to hear, and and what I like to do is these are junior people. These aren't procurement. They're not assigning contracts. But I like to get the name of the person, and then I typically will say, here, let me set you up with a little bit of free interpreting. It's only over the phone. It's not going to be in person, but try it out. And they'll try it out, and they're what I call your maverick spenders. Now, I might speak to. And I'm the CEO of the company. So account managers are doing this, and salespeople are doing this on a more regular basis. But I might then go and speak to 20 nurses, and people start to hear. There's this guy. He keeps giving us free interpreting. He's asking around, and we've used it, and it's not all that bad. And so then you'll get the head nurse call up and say, "Can you please stop driving my staff mad?" And I'll say, "I'm really sorry. We would like to bid on your contract, and we know it's not coming up for a year or so. And we just wanted to understand what the pain points are. I'm also a patient at your hospital from time to time. And, so I was there. Do you mind if I come in for a coffee or take you for a coffee?" You'll be amazed. Most of the time, they'll say yes. They won't always accept the free coffee because it's, like I say, it's regulated and they can't be seen to. Sometimes they insist on buying their own coffee, but you have a coffee with them and you hear. And then when you come and you write that RFP, it's a regulated process and it's a points win prizes situation. But you know what's turning those people on, what how they can give you points, what they're really looking for, what the meanings are behind the questions. And the other thing is, you can affect the RFP. You can't tell them what to write in it. But they can only write an RFP on a solution that they think is possible. So if you say, you don't have to wait for a face-to-face interpreter to show up, I can provide you with the video interpreter or an over-the-phone interpreter. Let me show you how it works. They're going to write an RFP now all of a sudden. that requires these different mediums. And maybe that small player that's out of Miami can't do that, or they have to do it for a third party, and therefore there's a double margin to make. So really, my advice to your listeners is, you'll be amazed. You know, I'll give people a bit of homework. Call up a CEO of a global 1000 business. Email them. You know, it's easy to guess their email addresses. It's usually first name dot last name. But call up or email and just ask for some advice. Don't ask them for a meeting. Just ask them for some advice. I think if you send out 10 emails, you're going to get one reply. You will get people, and the more senior people are, the easier it is, because a lot of people, when they reach a certain level in a business and financially, there's a level, there's guilt that comes with that. So you want to give back. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love doing these podcasts, because I feel like I'm doing something and giving back and giving something, you know, that people are, you know, can use to gain wealth on their own. So just do it, you know, just contact people, but don't go into that middle. The middle are too busy. They're actually having to do a lot of work. You go in at the very bottom, the you know, of the hierarchy, the nurses, the receptionists, or go right to the very top, the executive of the hospital. And I guarantee that you're going to find, I mean, well, don't hold me to it, but I bet you're going to find that 1 in 10, and that's not a lot. I mean, you can ChatGPT and edit an email and send it to 50 hospital executives, you're going to get 5 responses. Don't ask for a meeting. They don't have time. But ask for their thoughts or their advice. People love to give it.
Interesting. Tell us where entrepreneurs can connect with you.
So I'm actually going to launch my own podcast. It's going to be called ExecCraft. So you can look out for it. It's going to come out in the next couple of weeks. That's going to be on YouTube. My email is contact@joshuagould.com, and those are the two best places to get hold of me, and I try and respond to every email within 24 hours I get. And believe me, I get a lot of them, so my assistant Kyle is usually driving me mad, but you are getting me, and I try and be as hands-on as possible, Lily. So if any of your listeners want any help, want any support, I don't have endless time, but I can promise to try and be at least 1 in 10.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.